This episode of Startup Stories is brought to you by our friends at Pure Scooters. Save time, save money, and save the planet with an electric scooter from Pure Scooters, the UK's most trusted electric scooter provider. Stay tuned to the end of this show to learn how you can win one of two electric scooters we're giving away in partnership with Pure Scooters.
For most people, being part of a well-funded startup before you're 20 is living the dream, but Harry Hugo wanted to use what he'd learned to found a new kind of marketing agency, reinventing word of mouth for the 21st century. So he and his two co-founders set up the Goat Agency and started to win big clients by making promises backed by a guarantee: if we don't hit our targets, you don't pay. I'm Jeremy Parsons from MagicSubscriptions.com, and today, in Startup Stories with Adam Callow, you'll hear how Harry's simple idea, "What if we're just the agency that does what we say we can do?" has become a high-growth business that keeps on learning and experimenting every day.
Harry, thanks for joining us on the mics today.
Thank you very much. Yeah, appreciate it.
So let's get straight into it. For anyone that's listened to the show that doesn't know about the Goat Agency or actually influencer marketing, can you just sort of get everyone up to speed with who you are, what you do, and what you guys do here?
Cool. Yeah, I'm Harry. I'm 24. I'm one of three founders at the Goat Agency. We started the business 3.5 years ago. We started with no money. We saw a gap in the market, which was influencer marketing. And yeah, we've grown the business in 3.5 years to 120 people, with 4 worldwide offices in London, Monaco, Singapore, and New York. We're the biggest influencer marketing agency in the world, as far as we're concerned, in terms of the amount of money we bill to clients, the amount of money we put into the influencer market, the campaigns that we run with the clients that we have, the headcount we have. So it's been a mad journey. It's been a tumultuous journey. Like, it's been up and down. You learn a lot when it's your money at stake, which is awesome. And the project we had before, which I'm sure we'll talk about, it wasn't our money, so we learned a lot with other people's money, which was great. And when I talk about money, I'm talking about like 18 million quid in 2 years, so we managed to spend that very, very wisely on things that made us fail quickly, which meant that we could learn even faster. Yeah, it's been a crazy journey, but a very, very enjoyable one, and one that I wouldn't replace for anything else.
No, I like it. Just to dig into a couple of things there, for someone that doesn't know what influencer marketing really is,
of course.
What does that mean?
So yeah, influencer marketing is a technique that I suppose has been around for the last 3-4 years by utilizing people who have large social followings online. So the people you see on Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, Twitch, whatever the platform that you prefer is, who then are paid by brands to create brand messages, branded content in order to influence, which would be, I'm putting in hyphenated characters, but influence their audience to do certain things, buy certain products, talk about certain items, services, whatever it is, in order to influence decisions. And that's, I mean, it's the simplest form of marketing. It's word of mouth redefined for the 21st century, where word of mouth is now in a place where all of it happens in the social media sphere, rather than it used to happen in the pub, and now it happens on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. So the world's just changed. Social is everything, and influencer marketing is just the new word for word of mouth.
Like it. There's a couple of things I want to dig into while we're on the mics. Is firstly, I really want to learn about the first year, what it was like at Goat.
Yep.
Then moving on to scaling the team, and then how you've sort of moved budgets. You made a really good comment in one of the, I believe it was in one of the vlogs that you did, where you've moved campaigns from like £5,000 to £1 million. They're the budgets you're working with. I want to learn about that and how you've expanded those, whether it's with existing accounts or new accounts.
Yeah.
And then like the future of Goat and what you see happening in this space. But before we get into all of that, talk to me about Sports Lobster. What happened there?
Yeah,
God, like, what was that 18 million quid spend? What did you learn? And then sort of what gave you the confidence that you should do it again? Or sorry, do something yourself and not take on external capital? Because you haven't raised any cash.
Sport Lobster was a mad one. So I got brought in when I was 18. I'd already run a business when I was 16 in football.
Yep.
I got brought in by Aaron, who is now my co-founder at Goat. Who was the co-founder at Sport Lobster. I started on the same day as Nick, who's now the co-founder at Goat as well. And there's three of us here. He was an intern in the marketing department. I was working in the social department. There was literally five of us in a room. Aaron, his co-founder, a tech guy, me and Nick. And we sat in this tiny box room with a dream. The dream was that we were going to be bigger than Facebook, which sounds nuts. But when you buy into something so much, and when you talk about it and talk to other people about it all the time, then you just believe in it. Yep. And the best example of that is Fyre Festival, right? And it's literally that. And we had a dream, which we were going to be bigger than Facebook. We were going to be the sport version of Twitter, whatever. And it made sense. It was logical. The theory was great, because obviously people would want a platform where they can talk about sport, where it's built for sport fans. It has everything they want. Logically, it's brilliant.
Yep.
And it's why it was such a good investor product, because investors could buy into it, because you could tell a story and by the end of it, they go, why doesn't this exist? Whereas actually, in theory, social media was blowing up at that point. 2012, 2014, 15, social media was blowing up. Twitter was huge. It was like the center of sport conversation. If you wanted sport news on time, then you go on Twitter. And Facebook was still growing at that point, and it just introduced video. And Instagram wasn't really a thing anywhere near what it is now. And YouTube was big, but it didn't hold the same value. And yeah, we raised 18 million in 2 years. I went from a kid, 18, to a person who was running a 5-person social media team worldwide. We grew from 5 of us in a room to 70 of us. Nick became head of marketing. And between Aaron, Nick and I, we basically ran the marketing of the business. And we generated 2.5 million active users.
Yep.
on the platform. We did some mad stuff. We sponsored Premier League football teams. We sponsored the NFL. We sponsored the NBA. We sponsored everything you can imagine. We had Cristiano Ronaldo as our headline ambassador. He was a face of the brand. It was awesome. If you could,
sounds fun, man.
Yeah, if you could pick like an 18-year-old boy who loves sport and drop them into any job in the world over any period of time, 2012, 2014 was like the coolest time in sport anyway. You had the 2014 World Cup in Brazil, like everything you could possibly want. And then I got to do all of it.
With 18 mil budget behind you.
With 18 million quid, like which it. Meant that everyone wanted to talk to me because everyone knew I had the money. So
interesting.
Everyone
okay.
took me to everything for free. If I wanted to sit courtside of the NBA, I could sit courtside of the NBA. If I wanted to, on a Friday evening, I went, oh yeah, I really want to go and watch Liverpool this weekend, I could email the guys at Liverpool and I'd get a seat in the director's box the next day. Like it was that level. We were the golden children of sport. And because Aaron and Andy, the founders, weren't really, I mean, all credit to them, but they weren't really interested in the limelight, mm-hmm. despite having all the PR around the fact that we were growing so fast and we had the money. Nick and I were the face, and Nick was 24 and I was 18. So it was just crazy. And we got to do everything we could possibly want. And the beauty of the whole thing was we learned so fast. We were thrown in the deep end. I was given a million quid budget when I was 18. I was like, I don't have a clue what to do with this. But we were just forced to work it out, which is kind of the beauty of marketing, really. Like, no one is born into understanding how it works. All of the people who've ever succeeded in marketing, be it at brands, be it agencies, be it people who've run their own businesses, it's all because they've just been given a challenge and they've had to solve it. And that's what marketing is, problem solving, to find audience that you're trying to attract to your product and make them buy it. So we had the problem of we need users on the platform and we need them fast. And the solution was throw shit at the wall and hope it sticks. That was it. And then the beauty of that, when you have so much money, is when you're throwing that much shit at the wall,
something
of it sits.
Something's going to stick.
And influencer marketing stuck. And we're like, what is this? We paid one guy 10 quid, who I knew from my blogging days, and he drove 2,000 downloads. These are arbitrary numbers. He drove 2,000 downloads, and then we paid Cristiano Ronaldo a lot more than 10 quid. And he drove 2,000 downloads. And we're like, what? Like, this makes no sense. This person's got 100,000 followers. This person's got 120 million. He's the most followed man on the planet. And they do the same thing. So it's now not about followers. So we eradicated the thinking that followers were everything.
Yep.
Way before like all this influencer fraud, fake follower stuff, which we don't care about because we're like, followers don't matter. From that, we were like, okay, well, let's start tracking what works and what doesn't.
Just to zoom in on that, why is that the case, or why was that the case? Why is the person with the fewer followers? Is it just high levels of engagement?
Engagement and loyalty.
Okay.
No one really cares what Ronaldo has to say for himself. They just care that he's Ronaldo.
So at that point, was Ronaldo also pushing other things?
He was, but we had a third of his social media output.
Okay, so it's not in terms of it wasn't just like diluted
volume.
Down.
No,
okay, wow,
we
okay.
had, let's say he posts 5 times a week, we had 2 posts.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, it was the deal was crazy. And all credit to Aaron for doing that deal. It was crazy the amount of exposure we got across everything. And everyone in UK especially knew what Sport Lobster was in the industry. And we then realized, okay, well, let's pay £10 to lots of different people with 100,000 followers. And then we're like, okay, well, even at that level, it doesn't make a difference. So some people work, some people just got nothing. And we're like, okay, this is weird. So sort of understanding all that data and then recording that data, understanding why, understanding if there was a different call to action, if there was different, like all the different variables, and then just recording that and then realizing, okay, there's no rule. It's trial and error. And then we just built the biggest trial and error game in the world, right? This is it. It's an advertising channel, but good luck, because it's a minefield and there's no way to automate it. You have to just do it. And that's why it's like, it's the purest form of marketing, because you've got to put the money through in order to work it out. It's not just a surefire fix. And it's also why agency, or paying an agency to do it who knows what they're doing, is so much more valuable than doing it yourself, because you can waste so much money by doing this. And not everything works. We're not saying influencer marketing's perfect in every way, that every person with 100,000 followers or 5,000 engagements is going to convert to the same amount of downloads or sales or whatever. We're not. We're saying we know who is.
Okay.
And that's our gold mine. And as soon as we worked out that that person with 100,000 followers provided the same value as the person who paid way more than £10 was producing the same results, it was like, bang, this is it. And then we left Sport Lobster, and that was it.
So talk to me about that. How was the decision to actually leave Sport Lobster and then start up Goat? Like, what was that transition period like?
So Aaron went on his honeymoon in January 2015, and Nick and I were very senior at that business by then.
Yep.
And Aaron left, he came back, but he left the company after his honeymoon.
Okay.
He just didn't believe it anymore. It's difficult for him to keep selling to investors when you don't believe to it. And we made not a penny in revenue, so it was literally, we were burning cash. And we sat down with him when he came back, and we're like, look, just to let you know, we set our company up 3 months ago called Goat, Nick and I. And we run this one campaign for someone else because we realized how much power we had in the marketing team that no one else knew how to do this. So we just ran a campaign, which is the film poster over there, which is our first ever campaign.
That's cool.
There's only 2 film posters in the world of that film. It was that bad. One of them is our New York office, and one of them is our London office.
That's amazing.
We spent a fortune just tracking them down, just because it's like, that is like the awesome POS memorabilia. And we sat down in Coat Brasserie in High Street Ken. I remember very clearly. And Aaron said he wanted to set up a talent management agency. Mm-hmm. We said, we're not sure that's the way to go forward. So instead, let's just do it as an agency where we own nothing and we do it. And then Aaron saw the model, understood it, understood what we'd been doing. Because obviously he wasn't doing it every day at Sport Lobster, because we were running it every day. And then thought, okay, this is a huge opportunity. Why aren't we just doing this now? And then we was like, we literally shook hands at the table. Me and Nick walked back into the office, asked for a meeting with Andy, resigned. And then we started. I had gardening leave. Nick worked out for 4 weeks, and we just started from there. Nick and I were on pretty good salaries at that point. You know, I was 20, so I was earning way above my age range.
Yep.
And I had no savings because I'm rubbish with money. And I had a lot of rent to pay every month, and I just went, we'll work it out, and that was it.
Were you still thinking about sports as a niche?
Yes, sport was our okay. focus, because all we knew, when I talk about the trial and error,
yep.
all we trial and errored is sport pages, right? So all we could ever do at the start was sport that we knew we could deliver. And we understood, having spent millions of pounds on agencies at Sport Lobster, we knew that the value in an agency doing what they say they were going to do is greater than anything else, because we employed so many agencies that just didn't, they pitched the stuff and we're like, that's great, do that, and then they didn't do it, or they couldn't do it. It's like, well, what if we're just the agency that does what we say we can do? So the only thing we knew what we could do was sport. So we just did that. And we got our first client in the first weekend. They did $5,000. We delivered $10,000 worth of value. He spent $10,000 next week. Delivered $20,000. Like, it was literally like, bang, bang, bang. We're like, this is brilliant.
So talk to me about the company format. In those, in the sort of first 1 to 6 months, three-person team. So how quickly do you start scaling the business?
Aaron, Nick, and I. So we started officially in August.
And who does what in the company at this point? Like, what are the roles?
Aaron, Nick, and I started in August. That was our first campaign. Mm-hmm. Aaron was the sales guy. Nick was the customer relationship, like account management.
Yep.
And I was the guy who worked out. And that was always a dynamic, and it's still a dynamic. Mm-hmm. And it really, if you break down our whole business, even if it's 120 people, like, those are the three roles. You sell, you look after the customer, and put together proposals, and you deliver. They're the three roles.
But you roll that, this is something that I'm really curious about. So we're a relatively small team, there's 12 of us.
Yeah.
And as we sort of try and build out our company structure, like, I'm confused to how agency internal structures work. I actually heard, I think it was on one of your vlogs, in terms of like, you didn't go and look at what other agencies are doing. No. You just replicated.
I still have no idea what another agency looks like. I've got no idea. I've got friends at work and I'm like, why do you do that? And it's literally that. Why okay. do the sales guys create the proposals? Obviously they look shit because they're not designers.
Yep.
So let's get the best fucking designers in London building the most amazing deck. And it's just human psychology. When people look at something and it looks nice, they obviously think it's going to be better. Mm-hmm. And they think the quality of the work we deliver is going to be better. Now, we believe that work is way better and yep. it proves to be better. But a sell is everything. It's first impressions. It's what you wear. It's what the deck looks like. It's how you present the deck. Like, it's everything. So making different processes in the business work on the different things that we knew were important was very important. Now, that only came later. At the start, it was the three of us. That was August. By November, we brought in Frankie, who is my number two at Sport Lobster.
Yep.
Because we knew that between Nick and Aaron, we could go and sell pretty much anything, and we just had to work it out. So I needed more people to work it out with me. Frankie was the obvious choice. He came in, we worked out a bit more about how we could scale it. So by this point, we'd moved from football to sport, because they're very different things. And so me and Frankie work out how to do sport, and then we scaled it. We brought in Emily, who came in as an account manager to take the strain off Nick, because we were getting so many clients and me and Frankie could just deliver, because we're doing relatively small campaigns. So brought in Emily as account manager. She's now campaign director. She's moved across different sections of the business. And we didn't bring in a salesperson until 2018, so 3 years in.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Everything was sold through Nick and Aaron and I.
At that point, no funding. How are you guys getting paid? Or is it basically what you earn is what
profit.
You get paid?
Yeah, profit.
Okay, cool.
We still don't have salaries. We're still all dividends. It's profit from day one, every month.
Nice. I like that. You mentioned working on smaller campaigns and you grow the company. And now you started on 5K campaigns and now you do £1 million budgets.
Yeah.
But you seem to have done that very quickly in terms of how you increase the budgets. Is that a result of your clients becoming more receptive to influencer marketing? Like, are you just getting more budget from their marketing spend?
I'd love to say it's all because we're amazing. Okay. And there's certainly an element of that. But the market and the willingness to spend on influencers because of the PR, the results, mm-hmm. the everything that comes with it has gone like that, meaning that the budgets themselves have grown exponentially. So what we can potentially access is huge, but I think, like you referenced earlier, it's like, how can we were the only guys early on where we worked out that influencer budgets didn't really exist, but other influencer people were trying to sell influencer budget. That influencer budget was like $5,000. Basically it was a test and learn section of people's marketing budget. We realized that actually if we just package influencer marketing up as a media buy, then they've got millions to spend on media buy. So we'll just take 1% of that if we package it against that budget rather than this tiny budget that they're only going to be judging on certain things. We'll just go right up against the thing that they spend the most money on, and we'll just try and take a percentage of that. And if we end up taking 20% of the world's media buying budget, we'll be billionaires. And we're like, that's enough. that's enough. Like, for me, like, we're happy for loads of people to compete in this market because there's so much budget. Mm-hmm. We just believe that it's being wasted on the wrong media channels, or it's being oversaturated on the wrong media channels, where 100% of the budget is going towards Facebook paid or Google paid, whatever. And that's just not the right mix. Now, we 100% don't believe that all of your budget should go to influencer marketing. That is not our belief whatsoever. But we believe that the percentage of budget that is used on influencer marketing is massively under indexed to what it should be right now.
Okay.
And we think it should get to about 15-20%.
I'm really getting to the weeds of it now. So in those early days, sort of the 5-7 person company, how are you balancing the fact that you've got to spend your own cash to test at this point whether the influencers are new spaces
actually
driving value?
Yeah, this is where I suppose me and Frankie paid for ourselves in everything that we did. So we worked out how we could deliver the 100% of the results we guaranteed. So we guarantee results up front. So
what does that? I've heard you mention that on the vlog. What does that actually mean in terms of like downloads, impressions, view, whatever it is?
Whatever it is, we guarantee it up front. And you don't pay us if we don't hit it.
How do you have the confidence to do that?
We have the data. We know exactly what's going to happen, right?
But in the early days, you didn't have the... Oh, you did previously have some experience.
That's it. We only did the football stuff. So I knew exactly... And the beauty of the Sport Lobster thing was all I cared about was downloads. So all the impression, the followers, the impressions, the engagements, the clicks, all that didn't matter to us.
Irrelevant to
you
at that point.
It's downloads. Like, that's all brands care about. It's the thing right at the bottom of the funnel. Those things change. It could be downloads, it could be video views, it could be sales, it could be deposits on betting products, it could be all sorts of different things. But those things change. But all that matters is the bottom of the funnel. And it's about how you can be as efficient as possible down the funnel to get to the bottom. And we just cared about that. So we guaranteed against that. And then you don't pay us if we don't hit it. But we knew what was going to happen anyway. So
That's cool, man.
And where Frankie and I paid for ourselves is we were obviously building all the deliverables and what we were going to guarantee the client. Mm-hmm. And we worked out if we can guarantee them the results... And that's 100. So let's say we need to get to 100% to guarantee the result to get paid. If we can do that with 80, let's say we take a 40% margin. Mm-hmm. Which, again, these are all arbitrary numbers. So we spend 60% of the budget. What if we were able to deliver the results with 50% of the budget, and then we had 10%? Well, we could just test on the same shit.
Yeah.
But we could just trial stuff, and that was it. We just built an arbitrage machine where we knew we could deliver with X percent. So let's say 80% of the delivery, no, 100% of the delivery could be done by 80% of the budget. And the rest of the money, we could just push into things that would still be relevant for the client, but it might massively over-index or massively under-index, but it didn't matter to us because we knew we'd already done the numbers anyway.
Longer-term learning for you on budget.
Yeah, so we,
on budget
and now
agreed.
We do that with probably, so this year we'll spend 20 million quid on influencer payments. Mm-hmm. So we might spend 5 to 6 million quid trialing shit. But it doesn't matter to our clients. Clients are paying us to do it. Yep. It doesn't matter to them because we've already guaranteed them results. That 6 million quid might get them 400% more than we guaranteed, or it might get them 102%.
On that note, how do you structure that deal in terms of making sure that when you do over-index, that you capture some of the upside? Or is that not part of how
you structure
deals?
Yeah, it's not part of it. Like,
okay.
It's something we're looking at, but because it's trial, we don't really know what's going to happen. The second time we should probably do it, but yeah, but it's just kind of a beauty of the sell. If we say, look, we're guaranteeing the 100%, so anything past that, you're getting for free. It's like it's a no brainer.
It's why a retention tool for you guys. They just come back at the end of the day, don't they?
It's why we managed to win such amazing clients so early. We said to unknown. Anonymous huge tech brand, we'll guarantee you whatever you're getting through paid, we'll just do it cheaper. We'll just guarantee that. And they went, obviously we'll do that. And we went, great, we've got anonymous tech brand as a client.
Yep.
It was easy. Like, people are like, oh, how do I get leads? Just be ballsy. Like, what's the worst that can happen? Really? You know, and yeah, you might lose that client forever, but they're one client and there's thousands. And we had to take some punts. And also because it's our money, we always had to take huge step changes, right? In order for it to make a difference to us. And we've always wanted to earn more and more money as individuals. Mm-hmm. And now in order to do that, we've had to make more and more profit. In order to do that, we had to get more clients because we're not salaried. And it's because we didn't have any money in the bank.
Let's talk about that. It's a nice little segue in terms of the scale. You guys have got to a ridiculous scale from my perspective. Yep. in a short period of time. We're a 12-person team, and we're going to try and get to...
Hey, the fun years.
That's what I want to talk to you about is we're a 12-person team. We're probably going to get to 22 this time next year is where we're at. That's where we're going.
That's when it gets hard.
Talk to me about that. Like, where are the step changes that you've taken in the business?
Everyone's in a room.
Yeah.
In one room, and you can see everyone, and you can talk to everyone without.
Don't get me started on this, by the way, because we've outgrown our existing office, so there's like three little offices.
That's a nightmare.
Do you think that's I actually had a meeting with a guy last week, and he was like, "That's a huge mistake. Like, you need to be shoulders with the whole team. When you're 12 people strong, you should be shoulders with the whole team."
Like, yeah, I'd hate that.
You know Lee Wilcox?
Yeah.
So we're gonna have his office because he's moving soon.
So I actually messaged him yesterday. That's a good office.
Yeah.
But yeah, like if you at that size, the beauty of it is, and we were lucky again, we had the right space. You can talk to each other without shouting. Now that sounds really simple, but if I want to talk to someone that's at the end of this office, I have to walk for a minute in order to get there and then have a conversation. Now that changes the whole dynamic because I'd rather text them.
Okay.
And that changes the dynamic. So once we got to, one of our mistakes, was our second office, the one before this one, was two floors. And it made a huge divide in the company, upstairs and downstairs.
How many people were you at that point?
We moved in there when there was 22.
Okay.
And we moved out of there when there was 55.
Is that the first little, it's an interesting number, it's the same as ours, and where we're going to, and the goal. Is that the first bit of pain point you had in terms of size of team? Like, when did you start to think?
No, the first pain point was when we're very much of get as much value for money as we can out of a space.
Yeah.
So we were 22 people in an office before that, which could fit 10.
We've got it too good. I'm referencing our producer over there. We've got it too good at our space.
My first ever desk at Sport Lobster was a sofa. And my last ever desk at Sport Lobster was a table tennis table. So our attitude is like, let's just squeeze everyone in. And also the brilliant thing about squeezing everyone in is when you get a bigger space, the gratitude for it and the buy-in to that space is humongous.
Okay.
So when we moved into here, after being we were 55, 60 in a space that could fit 40, and I didn't have a desk for 9 months, this is awesome. Like, and the ability to make those huge steps, like when we were hiring people at the end of the last office, knowing that they were going to be moving into this office really, or hiring them to become members in this office, we'd still get them in for a week in the old office to get the fucking hell, it's annoying that no one's got any forks, like why is there only 16 mugs, there's 50 of us, like those things. And then you move in here and go, wow, this is awesome. And then that huge step change, people that come in here have only worked in here think this is like, this is just normal.
The norm.
This is not normal. This is like the top floor of Bloomberg's old building. This is the coolest office in London. But the requirement and the gratitude from people that have worked across all of our offices is ridiculous for this office versus people who've just worked in this office.
Okay.
And that's awesome. But yeah,
the step changes throughout the company from like the 10 to the 120 you're at now.
Yeah, so everything up until about 15-20 is a breeze. Because you know everyone personally. Like, we had a WhatsApp group chat. We were looking back on it a couple of months ago, where like we'd be chatting on Saturday night just about what each other were doing on Saturday night, like founders to new members of staff, and it was all in this group chat. I'm like, fucking hell, imagine if we did that now, like the mess that would make. We had to get rid of the WhatsApp group chat when we were about 75 because someone
waited till 75 people to get rid of the group.
People weren't talking about their nights out, but then someone gets pissed and they do talk about their night out on a Saturday night, big HR problem. Like, that is a nightmare. Okay. Right, so we had to get rid of the ability for one person to talk to the whole company.
Okay.
Immediately.
Yep.
But in the early days that was great, and you build these amazing relationships with people and everyone pulls together because everyone's in it together, and it doesn't really feel like founder versus staff, because you're all in the same room but all starting the same goal, and everyone's doing the same stuff, and everyone's doing everything, because yeah, your role is that, but we need to get this proposal out for New Look for £1 million. Let's all do that, because it's very important for the whole business to change. So those things were great. And then once we got to about 25, we moved into the other office, and we had people upstairs and downstairs. That was a problem, because not everyone could see what everyone was doing every day. Because then you start getting the people going, what is that person doing? Are they doing the same amount as I am? I'm doing loads of work. Like, I should get paid more. Or, like, I feel really undervalued because I'm downstairs. And it's like, fucking hell. It's like, I haven't even thought about that sort of stuff.
Okay.
And then by, like, 30 or 40, you're writing travel policies about who can fly what class at what hour. Like, I'm like, I was 16 about 3 years ago, worrying about what blogs I should put up, and now worrying about whether or not someone should fly premium economy with BA if they're at a certain level in the company, but only if they're flying for over 6 hours.
Are you doing that reactively because someone's had an argument about it, or have you got someone externally giving you advice?
Because never that. It was literally always reactive, and we were like, fuck, like, I don't even know. I don't know the answer. Like, someone comes to us and go, can I fly premium economy? I'm flying to Singapore. Like, yeah, I don't know. Like, what do other people do? And it was literally like, can you find out what other people do? Like, I've got no idea. And then just having to sit down and go, no, okay, these are our rules. HR process. We didn't have a finance person until January 2018. No one doing our finances. No one who had any idea. We turned over 6 million that year. We had no idea what we were doing. Apparently it was our CFO walked in October. He said he's never seen anything like it.
Had a mild heart attack when he looked at what you were doing.
Yeah, so we've only had a finance operation for a year, and we've been going 3.5. We were just like muddling through it, just hoping
this
that
is
cash...
making me feel so much better.
Yeah, oh,
I, honestly,
our,
it is.
Our business was an utter shit show for 2.5 years. But the thing that underpinned everything and made everything great, we made money. And that solves everything, because it makes everyone happy.
Yeah,
because they can see the results they're creating are profitable and successful and pushing the business forward. And we're not the sort of people that pull, like, we pay ourselves in dividends, so we pull the money, pull the profits. That's how we get paid. But we've always invested money into the business. Obviously, look at where we're sitting, look at the amount of people that are here.
But it feels like you're investing into the people significantly. I think I read a quote online which was, it's all like irrelevant about age, like if you're smart enough, you're old enough, or something to that effect.
Well, that's definitely really my philosophy, right? And it was Aaron's philosophy at Sport Lobster, and he trusted me very young to do cool stuff. And yeah, our average age is about 24. The average age in Frankie's team, so the campaign team, the guys actually doing it, probably younger than 24. And they're awesome. Like, our best members of staff are, like, 18 months ago we're stacking shelves in Tesco. Like, it makes no difference as to what background you have, what degree you have, whether or not you even went to university. I didn't go to university.
I lasted 45 minutes at university, by the way.
That's pretty good. 45 minutes longer than me. I did a few open days, just because it was like, you can get out of school. But yeah, like, that requirement for just, it's the intangible, just be smart and honest and tell me when you don't know something, because I'm sure someone here knows.
Yeah.
So
from the vlog, it feels like the team's got like a really great dynamic and real focus on the end goal.
Yeah.
I guess to ask the hard question is, what do you do when someone's underperforming, and how does that affect culture? Like, how quickly do you eject one out of the business compared to coaching them through it? So it feels like you hire people that might have the right attitude towards the work, and you mold them around the GOAT way of how to do campaigns.
Yeah, so I think it depends. So different roles require different things. Mm-hmm. We're very brutal when it comes to hiring and firing. And in order to really succeed in business, you need to be. Not everyone you're going to hire is going to be the right fit. And we understood that pretty early on. And that's kind of at that 20-25 stage.
Okay.
And we were beginning to hire in fours and fives and knowing that we were going to get rid of three. And what defined us as leaders in the business was our ability to get rid of three and it not affect culture.
How do you do that?
Pretty honest at the start.
Okay.
You know, that not everyone makes it here. We make it out, and we kind of believe it, but we make it out as if, like, this is the Harvard of influencer marketing.
Yeah. Right?
So you've got to be fucking good to get in. So well done. now you've got to be really good to stay in, and you've got to want everything, because we're going to give you all the tools. Doesn't matter who you are, if you're in the door, you get all the tools. Make use of the tools. Like, we'll give you anything you want. And we know that within about, so in the campaign team, this is me, because I spend most of my time with that team, which is, yep, the biggest team in the company, is about 65 70, something. We can tell if someone's going to be good within a month, and we can tell if someone's going to be awesome within 3. And some people get to 3 and they're good and they'll stay because they're good. But within a month, we'll pretty much make a decision as to whether or not they're going to stay or not. Because we've got very clear criteria as to what they need to be able to know, how good they need to be. A lot of it is intangible. The ability to cope with pressure is like 90% of the requirement.
It's mandatory here.
Yeah, okay. It's so important. It's kind of what led my success in the delivery stage early on, when it was like 3 or 4 of us. Mm-hmm. It was like, okay, we know there's a problem. Like, just give me 10 minutes and I'll work it out. And then be able to go back in, like, figure things out, move things around, and go, okay, I've got it. This is how we're going to do it. And then that work, but the panic, if panic in that team causes panic across the whole company, because those are the guys men know what to do.
Yeah.
Okay. So I was like, ooh, calm down. Like, we've done this before. We know things go wrong. We're an agency, right?
Yeah, like a trained firefighter at that point.
So just, okay, that's why Frankie's really good. It's like, whoa, let's calm down. What have we done? What's not worked? Why are we spending that on that? Can we pull that budget back in? Like, all these just simple things, but you can't think like that if you're panicking. So, yeah, the most basic way of putting it is the campaign team are basically stock trading. Because it's an arbitrage, because it's trial and error, like, we are stock trading value in the influencer market, and
you can measure results,
and we can literally measure live results. Yep. So that's really important to keep your cool. And then the other part is just be smart. Like, there's things that you can do here which are, like, perception is a big thing in a growing company when you're trying to stand out and trying to grow. Like, leaving at 6:01 is not going to get you very far, mm-hmm, with your line manager, because they're going to see you leave first every time. Now, unless you're in at 7 a.m. every morning and people know that, then the perception play there is not smart. When you're 12 people, it's like, But when you're 100 people, that's a very different thing.
Yeah.
Especially when we're so open to giving people opportunity, and that's been our biggest success. Our biggest success is, like, you're young, you're smart, you're in. You got through the interview stage, well done. Here are all the tools. We give you a week worth of training where you don't really touch the business. You touch all the senior leaders in the business. They taught you through how to do things, like the ultimate induction. And then it's like,
go.
Do. Like, here's your campaigns. It's worth 200 grand. It's worth a worldwide brand. You're going to be working alongside these people. Let's go. And opportunity, right? And it all stems from Aaron giving me the opportunity.
That's a culture that you guys built from day dot, basically.
6 years ago, and going, he's £1 million, just work it out.
On that, one thing that I'm super interested to know is, at what point do you feel the need to bring in some...
Senior figures,
yeah, grey hair into the business is what I've been like.
Yeah, so the oldest person in the business is 34, 33.
Jesus.
So pretty young.
Yeah.
But we have, like, what I'd call the business support team,
yep,
which is a mix between HR, recruitment, operations, finance. Mm-hmm. That's business support. That's like 15 people. That team is by far the oldest. And that team is basically mine, Aaron's team.
Okay.
Nick Martin, CFO, came in from KPMG. He's 32. He's done 10 years at KPMG in Singapore. 2 years in Singapore, sorry, and 10 years in KPMG total. He's director level at M&A. So, you know, we're obviously looking to potentially acquire some things this year and next year. So that was interesting for us, and we knew we needed a smart CFO. So he came in. Josh, who sold his online jewelry business last year to the Heineken family for an extortionate amount of money, called Misoma, which is a huge jewelry brand in the UK. He came in as global director of operations. Again, like, people, he must be 30, but it's not so much about age, it's about bit of work life experience, yep. and being able to bring in the ability to question why and then give us potential other solution or an alternate view.
I guess it's having the respect for the person who's questioning the why. Like, yeah, when you bring someone in, you need to respect why.
Yeah, and why I've just brought in Dan, who I set up my business when I was 16 in, because he's been running that business for 8 years, right? And it's a small business, but he's been through some shit because it's a small business and it's still a profitable business. Again, we raised 50 grand at the start just to build some websites, but and I raised money from Aaron's dad. So there's a nice little cycle going. So he's been through some shit over the last 8 years and ups and downs, some awful ups and downs, but he's dealt with it all brilliantly. And so it was like, no brainer, I'll help him sell that business. And we just sold it like a couple weeks ago. But you come work with me, I'll give you a pay rise, this is the situation, this is what I need you to do. And it's like, bang, like, perfect. Someone who just got that alternate view, who has a bit of life experience of running a business, and can just, we sit, because Aaron and I, especially, and Nick in the US is a bit different, but Aaron and I are like whirlwind ideas machines. We're like, oh, why don't we do this, like this, and then let's just spend 50 grand on this. Like, and it's we need people around us, and that's why Nick works so well.
Slow down, guys.
Like, whoa, yeah, okay. Why are you doing that? What's that going to do? But don't forget, we're trying to do this in the long term, and that's just completely.
Is that because the size of the bets that you guys want to make now are just larger, and the risk is higher?
No, it's the amount of things we want to do.
Okay.
The bet is like, that's the fun bit. Like, I want to spend 100 grand on doing something that we're looking at buying a football club. That's one of our things, because it's like, why not? we sat in August last year, Aaron and I, around this very table on the 31st of August, and went, God, transfer deadline day is boring now. And went, what if it wasn't? What if people were coming into this office and we could actually sign players on this table? That'd be brilliant. How do we do that? And then the next meeting was a hospitality budget meeting. And it worked out about 100 grand we spent on hospitality over all our clients this year. And we're like, how much it cost to buy a non-league football team? Like, do it up and build like the best hospitality experience possible at a non-league team that we owned. And it came out about 100 grand. And we're like, well, scrap the hospitality. We'll just buy a club and make it the best corporate hospitality day in the world.
That's cool, man. That's
so, like, just because we like to do shit, I don't know. Like, there's so much opportunity in this space, and we just want to be a part of it all. It's so exciting. We want to set up award shows. We want to put on events. We want to podcast. We want a daily vlog. Like, the daily vlog was just me going, we should probably do this. And then I hired Matt. So we said we should probably do this on Thursday night. We had no one in the VA team at that point, and we hired four people who all started on Monday. On Friday, Matt was having his body painted by my girlfriend, who's body artist, on Friday, and he's a cameraman, which is complete luck of the draw. And Vicky said, "Oh, Harry's looking for a cameraman. We should probably go and meet him." And I text him immediately saying, come to London in the next hour. And we sat on those sofas over there, and I went, right, you got the job. So it starts Monday, 9:30, bring your camera equipment and we'll just get going. And we vlogged and we released our first episode that Monday. And we had a team of four, and we have a team of four that just works on the vlog.
Is that because you guys don't have to answer anyone? Because you've raised no cash.
Big.
Yeah, you've raised no cash, you answered to no one, and if you want to make your own bets, you do so.
Yeah, and it's our money.
I'm jealous, man.
Because, yeah, if we lose hard.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's... But when we win, it's like, yes, what a great decision that was. And no one else can take the credit above us, which is awesome. And it was just never the case at Sport Lobster. It doesn't matter how great we were, we've always been funded by that bloke over there.
Yeah, okay.
And that's just like... It's like the... The best analogy is like old school Top Gear, where they do like a huge road trip and they build their own cars, and then one break down, and then you just have that little car that come round, like the Mini that was like battered, and you just like look at the camera and go, this is like the booby prize. That was what having an investor felt like. It's like when something went well or went badly, that guy just came around the corner and went, don't forget me, like, yeah, I'm over okay. here, like, what, either what the fuck's going on, or oh, it's great that I was managed to...
I'm part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's
okay.
Like, fuck off. Like, I'm trying... Obviously, I'm trying to do the best for the company.
Yep.
So
talk about the best for the company. What does GOAT look like in the next 3 to 5 years?
Yeah, that's really tough. Obviously, we've only been going for just over 3 years. So to project
it's a really good point. You're 3 years old. 12 months out from now, what is it
12 months out from now, I think we'll be 220, 250 staff.
Mm-hmm.
A couple more international offices, probably Australia.
I was going to say, are those new staff in other locations predominantly?
Most of them will be in the UK, I think.
Okay.
I don't think we'll get, outside of New York, I don't think we'll get past like 15, 20 in any other office. New York, I think we'll get to 40, 50, 60 maybe.
On that note, are those offices as a result of your clients wanting you to be more global, or because you see an increase in influencer?
We took the bet.
That's cool.
The bet on Singapore was literally, the bet on Singapore was actually a bet on Alex. So he's 26, he billed £7 million last year individually. Just on influencer work last year. So he's the biggest billing salesman in influencer marketing worldwide. I'm mm-hmm. very confident in that. There's no individual doing that much money who's not a founder. And we were like, okay, well, in order to develop him to potentially be a leader of the whole business in the future, he needs to have gone and run his own business at some stage. So let's just send him to Singapore if he wants to do it, and we'll give him all the business support of setting up all the admin stuff, but he's got to start from scratch. And we'll give him a tiny team of two or three people, locals, and then just see what happens. And he did $500,000 in his first 2 days. And we're like, what a fucking bet. but his personal development is actually what we're betting on there.
Yeah, 100%.
He's like, can he come back in 6 months' time
and be ready? Business in the next 2, 3, 5 years.
And be ready to be CEO 3 years' time and run a 1,000-person business. That's what we want. So that was that bet. But the bet with Nick was, our first international office was New York.
Mm-hmm.
We probably all the other stories from all the other like digital founders that we know had set up in New York and failed because they sent someone else. And we're like, okay, well, our only solution is to send a founder. Who's going? Look around the room. Aaron wasn't going to go. I wasn't going to go. We're like,
sorry, mate.
And he's done an awesome job. He's been out there a year, probably going to do another year. He's actually flying back today for the awards. And he's in the office all next week. And it's his first time forever. I think he's only ever been in this office for like 8 hours. We've had it for a year. So he's spent all his time out there. He made a huge life sacrifice for us in order to do that. But he's done an awesome job. There's like 18 people now out in New York. And we didn't hire the first person until I was there. So October. He did it all on his own. And again, very similar to Alex, Nick had never run his own business before. He'd only ever done it with us.
Okay.
I'd run my own, Aaron run his own. So like, it was a big thing for us to go, Nick, go and do it, mate. Like, I want you, at the end of this, if we sell and we all want to do it.
And are they acting like CEOs for that?
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
It's cool. Well, obviously he's a founder.
Yep.
But he's running the US.
Okay.
He doesn't really check in on the UK. So yeah, it's cool. Like, I don't know, where are we going to be in 12 months? I'd like to be in Melbourne. Seems like a big market.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to be in Dubai. I'd like to have another European office, Berlin or Amsterdam.
What's the benefits of having a
global localized office?
Okay.
The briefs that come out of New York or Singapore, actually, or UK, are global. And the ability to pitch for global business when you have more global locations and more localities is much bigger. And obviously global briefs are much bigger than local briefs. So that's big. And also like the certain locales just pick up local work. So point that's having an office, in my opinion, in Italy, because all that budget gets taken out from the UK and France. Whereas having a office in Berlin is very powerful because Germany speaks German, mm-hmm. and German is only in Germany, so all budget for Germany is decided in Berlin.
Okay.
So it's you literally you're very rarely getting budget in the German market, and it'll only ever come from Amsterdam or UK unless you're in Germany. So you have to be there in order to get access. Same as Singapore. You're not going to get any Asian budget unless you're in Singapore.
Okay.
So forget it. Unless you get very lucky. So it's about being seen. And there's just huge advantages to being places. The 24-hour advantage is massive for mm-hmm. us now. Like, we operate 24 hours. And if we need to hand campaigns across, if they're going really well, we need to capitalize it, or going not so well, and we need to make sure things are being sorted, we can handle it 24 hours, which is really, really beneficial.
So We like to end the show with some fast fire questions.
Yep.
But before we get into that, I guess one of the things that I want to throw in there, it wasn't on my notes actually, is what's the thing that keeps you awake right now? What's the thing that you worry about?
The problem,
about?
Yeah. Everyone asked me this. And at Sport Lobster, it was literally everything.
Okay.
But now it's nothing. Like,
is that because the company's at a different position now?
No, it's because I'm in control.
That's interesting.
At Sport Lobster, I had no control about the end result. I could just do my bit.
Mm-hmm.
And my bit was never going to be enough to make the company successful or not. It was going to be a decent amount, but it was never going to make it boom or bust, right?
Yep.
At Go, my job is everything. So if I can't sleep at night, then I'm not doing enough. I feel like I'm doing all right.
Yep.
So that's it. And if I'm not, then I've got to look at myself. And that's the dynamic. If I'm in control, I reckon I can figure it out.
So you sleep pretty well now?
Yeah, I sleep great.
That's cool, man.
I've got no... Aaron's worse than me at that stuff.
Okay.
He worries more. And it's kind of... I think the biggest thing and the biggest advice I'd give to any founders is get either if you're a single founder, get a senior team immediately. Or if you're a single founder that's just starting something, go and find another one. Go and find another founder. Because a problem shared is a problem halved. Yep. And a problem shared amongst three is a problem thirds.
That's
and
my
it's
regret, you know.
Way better.
I've not, like, it was just me for like, it was 6 years old as a business. What we've been doing now is about 2.5 years old, or 3 years old. It's, I wish I found a co-founder just to have someone
then
along the journey.
Then my advice would be go and find another business that you can go with and you can merge.
Okay, that's interesting.
That's what lots of agencies do that.
Okay.
You find another agency founder who's in a similar position to you. Maybe you're both doing 2 million turnover. You're both similar EBITDA. And you go, look, we're much better as a team. I really like you. Bang. Let's go together, rename it or hybrid the name. And then it's... Well,
that's
a few
cool.
people that did that.
Yeah, I never heard about that. And to be honest, you just tackled the last question of the quickfire. So we'll jump into them. Okay.
Yeah.
So number one is, what is the one thing you would... I've just realised how close you are in terms of the age gap. Normally, the last people I'm speaking to, there's a bit more of a gap. So what is the one thing you know now that you tell your 18-year-old self?
Keep networking. Keep meeting people. Make the most... People pay money for advice. Get the advice for free.
That's what I'm doing right now, mate.
Yeah, exactly. That's it, right?
It cost me a train down to London,
yeah,
and I get this time.
When I first started, all I wanted was advice from the journalists. Football journalist. I just wanted to be in football journalism. So the only way to do it was going to talk to every football journalist. Now, I created a podcast where I can invite them on, where I can give them an audience. I went to every pub, which I knew journalists hang out at after work. I bought them pints. It cost me £5, but they'll remember my name for the rest of their lives. And I go for dinners. I still, even though they're, and you know, this is probably unfair, but they're relatively useless to me now, given the career path I've taken versus what I thought I was going to take.
Mm-hmm.
I still take them out for dinner every 6 months because I owe so much
like
to
that.
People like Tony Evans and Henry Winter and those guys who gave me so much time and effort when they didn't need to. Mentorship. People pay non-execs for advice. They pay advisors and things like that. Like, you can create a brilliant network of advisors and mentors, all sorts of different ages, all sorts of different experiences, all sorts of different verticals for free if you put in the work.
Like it.
So, yeah, I just... tell myself to just keep going. Like, you're doing the right thing. Go and meet people. Go and spend the money you have. Although it's no money, it sticks in my mind. And find things that those potential mentors love. And for some of them, it was, you know, a drink after work. And that was it. And all I needed was £5 in my pocket. And I could make them remember me for the rest of my life. And that's so valuable. And it's been so nice having some of those guys who literally met me when I had nothing walk into this office and go, fuck me. And then we go through our like Twitter DMs what we sent to each other in like 2012, just me asking for stuff and chasing them for things and like, fucking hell, this is cool.
That's cool, man.
Relationships
really
are
like that. What's the number one tool, service or hack that you use to get work done that our listeners might not have heard of?
So I'm not very good at using things. I'm WhatsApp man. My laptop's on my desk here, but I hardly open it.
I've got members of my team that do that. I swear they're just like slapping the keyboard.
Yeah, I'm a phone man. My screen time on my phone is pretty unbearable.
Do you think you could run the business from your phone?
Yeah,
phone
100%. Yeah.
Okay.
100%. Yeah, I don't need a laptop. All my business is WhatsApp or email. But things that people use in the team, Monday, which is like a planning tool.
We use it. Struggling with it.
Really?
We'll probably need to come and sit in one of your how to use Monday sessions.
The proposals team do that in terms of assigning tasks and understanding where they are in the flow. We use Salesforce, which is pretty book standard. I think really the biggest tip is see how much value and learn everything that Google Docs can do, because it can do so much that you're probably using tools that you think are really, you're probably paying for tools that are really expensive that Google Sheets can do and Google Slides can do and Docs can do, and there's so many different plugins that you can add into Google that make it great that my tip would be slim down the amount of tools you use because they can overcomplicate things as much as making them easy. I like Trello because it's super easy, super simple to just see things, but we're whiteboard guys as well, so
we'll wheel
those around, and I'll show you around the office later. I'll show you how many whiteboards there are in this office. It's like people getting things on paper, like the proposals team, as you can see through the door, like they have two whiteboards, they're just constantly putting stuff on, like going, this is the situation. Yeah, I like that.
Is that something individually for brainstorming? Is that visibility for the rest of the guys that are working on the same thing? Just out of curiosity.
Both, I think.
Okay, cool.
Both.
Next one for me is, what's the best piece of advice you've been given and who gave it to you?
God, that's hard. What do I say to that? My mum said I'd never make any money online. That's a great piece of advice because it made me want to prove her wrong.
Yep.
And I start all my keynotes with that, like her quote. So that's good. I don't know. I think some of the advice that we give out now is, I can't remember who said it to me, but I definitely am regurgitating things that other people said. And it might have been Aaron that said it to me when I was 18. It's like, stop trying. Like, you're really good. Stop trying to impress me. Like, stop doing loads of shit that is completely unnecessary to just try and impress. Like, you're really good. Just do that. Like, do what you're really good at. And there was a few people in here that came in and they're like hustle and bustle and like asking, like, it's like, whoa, chill out. Like, we know you're good. Don't worry about it.
Okay.
Like, you're going to be judged on what you do, not what you say you do and how much, like, I don't care.
Yeah, results-driven company here.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that, and make sure people like you, because people only buy from people they like. No salesman, no hated salesman has ever been a millionaire.
No, I agree. I'm a salesman at heart. That's all I'm good at, to be honest.
So that's probably the best piece of advice in order for us to build the business is make sure they like you. And we've always, when Nick, Aaron, and I started this, were, and tonight hopefully will be a good proof of that in the awards we're going to, because we've always been the guys that people like and they like to spend time with and hopefully just like to hang out with. And, you know, we're going to an awards do with the sports industry, of which we've been in for 6-7 years, and we know everyone there. And the proof in the pudding will be how many people come up to our table rather than us having to go to them. I'm hoping that...
That's a nice way of measuring it. I like that. Yeah,
that's cool.
What was the last thing you looked at and thought, I can make a business out of fixing that problem?
Vlogging. B2B marketing.
B2B, like it, okay.
Because we couldn't do it. We literally couldn't do it. Like, the only work we've ever turned away is B2B. And so we're just building a case study for ourselves. Like, how, obviously you've got the Gary Vee stuff where he's created his own personal brand. Like, we're not trying to do that. We're trying to create a company brand. And no one's done that.
So would you say that's the motivation behind the vlog, to you to sort of get proof of concept that this thing works?
There's a few motivations behind the vlog. It's proof of concept in order for us to sell it. It's proof of concept as a business for other people to know about us as a business, and then they buy stuff. There is internal communication, which has been massive, massive, massive for us because of international. People can see what people are doing. It comes back to that upstairs, downstairs thing I talked about earlier, where people didn't know what people are doing. Now they know everything. And we did a survey in the office before we started the vlog, and one of the main motivation for us to actually do it was that in the surveys, 1 to 10, how much do you know of what the directors do every day? And the average was 2.5. And we're like, wow, like, why don't we show people? Like, I don't do anything fucking secret squirrel. Like, I just do stuff. And when I go around and people ask me what I've done today, it's very difficult for me to tell them because I'm like, I'm genuinely not sure. I've done loads of little things. And I end up just saying, I just make sure everyone gets paid. That is my job. It breaks down into loads of little things, and that's quite difficult to break down, so we just like show it as it happens.
Like it. If you recommend one book or podcast, what is it?
I love the On the Tools podcast. Like, something that's just a bit different, a bit fun. Like, the reason I love Lee and Adam and Andy, and I love Jamie as well, is because they just don't take themselves too seriously. And that's kind of the feel we want to get across in the vlog as well. Mm-hmm. For us, it's like, everyone who takes a business a bit too seriously is a bit of a wanker. It's like, there's so much more to life than this.
Yep.
And that's why I love Lee and those guys, because like, they've realized, and they're so self-aware to the fact that they've just stumbled upon something that's great, and they're like, let's just enjoy it, because it's God knows how long it's going to last. And that's very much my opinion of this as well. Like, I don't know how long this is going to last. That's why we're trying to scale as quickly as possible, because we're trying to future-proof ourselves. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'd go for the How's Your Week Been podcast with Lee Wilcox. So that's the thing, I actually watched it late last night with Jamie Boulding, who's another good friend of mine.
That's on my list to listen to on the way back.
Yeah, actually, he did a really good job actually, Jamie. And again, it just realised like, those boys can get the best out of the guests, and because they just make them relax. It's like, they're just laughing at the guys, like, just makes it brilliant.
I was on like 2 weeks ago, and he knew where to press me to get the things he wanted out of me.
He's great.
Like, great interview. The last one is, who's had the largest impact on your life?
I don't know. That's really hard. I think I've gone through lots of different stages. I think it's a bit of a cop out if you say your parents. Mm-hmm.
I think everyone today has, by the way.
Okay, yeah. See, I don't know, like, okay, so let me caveat that. I think, so my mum's a single parent.
Yep.
My dad owned restaurants all my childhood.
Yep.
So for two different reasons, they showed me a lot of different things. Mum showed me that you can do it on your own, and doesn't matter what adversity you face, you can work it out. Mm-hmm. And she always gave me the best that she could, and it was, I had an amazing child. I went to the best schools in the country, public state schools. But I always went to the best in the country. We lived in the best areas. I played the best golf clubs. Like, everything I wanted to do, I had, but we had no money. But she made it work.
A lot of respect for that.
Yeah, and she went to court to get me in the right school. Like, she did everything.
That's cool, man.
And my dad showed me that hard work paid off, and taught me everything about coping under pressure. Because I worked in professional kitchens when I was 13. I trained as a chef when I was 13. So I was doing 100 to 200 covers a night when I was 13, 14. So like, that pressure thing was like, this is easy, man. Like, the thing that I vowed to my mum at 15 was like, I'm not going to become a chef because it's awful. You couldn't pay me to do that job. It's awful. But when I was 13, 14, 15, I was earning the most in my school because I was doing a fucking job.
Yep.
And I literally was looking at people doing, like, complaining about like post rounds and things like that. I was like, you don't have a clue, mate. I just served AA Rosette fucking food to 200 people last night, and I'm knackered. But that taught me so much. But Aaron gave me the chance more than anyone else. So he's had a sort of later life. But the thing that made the most significant change, and is going to be very left field, was my sociology teacher in A levels. I was a really good academic student. Mm-hmm. Straight A's at GCSE, predicted straight A's or A stars at A level. At AS, I just went, I don't need this anymore. I built websites at that point. I was making money. I could do it, and I was kind of stimulating myself in other things. And I dropped psychology because I got like an E or whatever, and then I left history, IT, and sociology. And they brought in the rule the year I started that college that you could have a laptop in lessons, because that was just how it worked, right?
See where this is going.
And IT and history banned me from having a laptop because I wasn't doing anything. I was doing my own shit. My sociology teacher sat me down and went, I've heard the other lessons have banned it. Now I'm going to make a deal. I know you make money. Go and buy another laptop, do your work on one, and do your sociology work on another. And I went, deal. And I got an A in sociology, and I got D's in my other lot. And I'm like, that changed my life, because he allowed me to do everything I wanted, and I still had the ability to do it. Like, I was way above what I what I was learning. Like,
it's the same thing you do here. Like, if you're smart enough, we're going to trust you to get the stuff done.
Yeah, just, I can figure it out.
Yeah.
Just give me the tools, right? Give me the tools to do what I want to do, because if you give me everything your side, I'm going to give you everything my side. And I do so much work for sociology. Also, I was really interested in it. Mm-hmm. But that moment changed my life.
Feels like it's had a big impact in terms of how you run the business here, to be honest.
I think
it's a
big part of it. But also just that I could dedicate time to something that I knew was going to further than my A-levels. And he saw that, and he was a really smart guy. And another guy who I keep up to date with every 6 months and take out for dinner. Because I've got so much respect for him. And he introduced me to those journalists because he was a former BBC journalist. And it's like very sort of unknown quantity. Mm-hmm. And my mum will hate me for not picking her. But she got a shout out, so should be happy with that. And my dad won't listen. So I think him. And Aaron for sure. In the work life, yep. Aaron, but in terms of that moment where someone trusted me to do the shit I was good at, Chris Thompson, my sociology teacher. For sure.
Absolutely love that, mate. Listen, I could keep talking. I honestly think I could keep talking to you for the next 3 hours, but you're a busy
man.
Yeah,
it'd be a great podcast. I feel like Joe Rogan.
For people listening to this right now, where can they learn more about you?
Watch the daily vlog. I think that's something.
Where's the best place? Where do you want to direct them to go find it?
YouTube, I suppose. The Goat Agency on YouTube, or LinkedIn on the Goat Agency's channel as well. We release every day about 6, 7 p.m. the whole story of the day before, vlogged by the lovely Matt over there, who's celebrating behind the camera. We have a team that just follows Aaron, I, Nick, and the rest of the team. It's not a personal branding thing. We're not wankers. We're not going to tell you how to run your business. We're just going to show you how we run ours. And you'll meet amazing characters. And the beauty of it is that there are some amazing characters in every office, and we've just managed to pluck out a few and show them their lives as well. And yeah, it's been a lot of fun. We've learned a lot. And I'd implore everybody who has the capability to do it to create more awesome content, because if you're a founder, if you're doing something in a business and you want to look back on it, there's nothing better than being able to watch every single day of your life for a whole year. And that's where I want to go. I think this is going to be the best year of my life, and it'd be awesome on January the 1st. When I have the day off on New Year's Day in 9 months time now, that I can watch every single episode of my life from the last year. That'd be awesome. And then in 10 years time.
Mate, absolutely loved it. Appreciate your time. Cool. Thanks for being on the show, mate.
No worries, man. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this startup story. We aim to bring you first-hand stories every week, and you can help us out by rating the show on your podcast provider or head to nbs.fm where you can sign up for sneak previews and more. If you have an idea for a guest for Adam with a story to tell, you can email me on jeremy@nbs.fm. In the next episode, Adam talks to a guest who turned a simple idea into a hobby product with just a few keen customers. Then, the tool that he built to bypass government control of telecoms hit the front pages, and he became an accidental activist with a product used in 190 countries. Make sure you've subscribed to Startup Stories from nbs.fm, and I'll see you next time.
Hey guys, thanks for sticking around to the end of this episode of the Startup Stories, sponsored by our friends over at Pure Scooters. Save time, save money, and save the planet with an electric scooter from Pure Scooters. Now it's your opportunity to win one of two scooters.
Now Adam, this sounds awfully familiar to me. What was the closing date of the competition?
So it was the 17th of July. But you've reminded me that that was the last episode of the season, and the closing date was meant to be the 17th of August. You see, this is what happens when you leave me to my own devices and I record an advert on my own.
So that means, guys, that you've still got time to enter the competition and win one of two free scooters from Pure Scooters.
And we've made entering super simple. Head over to pure.nbs.fm. That's pure.nbs.fm to enter to win one of these two scooters that we're giving away on the 17th of August. We're going to do a live prize draw within our Facebook group. If you're not a member yet, head over to Startup Diary Club on Facebook, so you can watch the live prize draw. In case you miss it, don't worry, we will be releasing an episode to announce the winners.
And thanks again to our friends over at Pure Scooters for sponsoring Startup Stories.